Welcome to Hark, the 87th Precinct podcast. This is the podcast for book five in the 87th Precinct series by Ed McBain, and it's Killer's Choice. Now, I've seen two different things. Some sources say this was published in 1957, some say 1958. And while that might not be much of a thing, it really annoys me to not know exactly. So, mine and Steve-O's books will have 1958 in it at the front, I think.
Mine also.
Okay, so we're going to stick with 1958. So when I get to the years bit in a moment, we'll use 58. So I do have, of course, Mr. Stephen Royston here.
Good evening.
And Mr. Morgan Brown.
Why, hello there.
We've just watched the TV episode of the 87th Precinct, which is based on this story, and we'll talk about that in the bonus episode. We'll deal with the book first. I've got some orders of business, gentlemen.
Okay.
Some things we need to deal with.
Fire away.
Including questions, one of which was received literally 2 minutes ago, which is, so well done, Mr. Stephen Morse, on your timing. But I'm going to start with the really important question of the day, and I do feel, Steve-O, this might be in your in your wheelhouse somewhat, this. You maybe have to be the one answering this. This comes from highly respected academic Dr. Andrew Davies.
Okay.
And he wants to know, who would Ed McBain want to win the 2017 Snooker World Championship?
God, let me have a think. Mark Ofu.
Any reason for that?
Absolutely not.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Okay. Any other contenders that you think might interest him?
No, I think, he would admire his skill, but relative underachievement in his career.
Oh, right, so you think, he's
pushing
against the odds.
He's probably getting knocked out as we speak.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well done. Yeah, you go. Well done, Andy, you've jinxed him. So there you go. That's the definitive answer of the question that people have been thinking about for years. Even before 2017, people wanted to know what Ed McBain would have thought about the potential winner of the World Snooker Championship.
Now we know.
Definitely.
Rooting for the underdog.
Yes.
A question from someone else, one of our Twitter followers.
It begins.
One of our Twitter
followers. Is it because I mentioned Marco Fu?
I don't know. One of our Twitter followers. This comes from someone whose Twitter handle is at hyper_79. Doesn't have a profile pic, so I don't know who or what they are. And they use the name Stealth.
Gosh.
Which is very dramatic. Hello, Stealth. Or hyper number 79, the 79th of the hypers. But it's a good question. Which 87th Precinct novel would make a good, big-budget, all-star 2017 film? It's a good question,
it's
a tricky question, I think.
That might need some thought as opposed to an immediate...
I think we should cogitate on that one a little bit.
Maybe.
Because, we spoke in the last episode about casting and things like that, and we said we were going to go away and try and think about people who'd be in the cast, and I couldn't think of anyone at all, because I just don't really know actors that well, and plus I have this, that natural instinct of you can't just cast Tom Hiddleston again type thing, and then I can't think of any other actors. So I didn't think of anyone. But it's a good question, and I think probably my initial instinct was some of the 70s and 80s ones lend themselves more to that sort of thing to be adapted.
Maybe
in that
some of
scale.
There's a few later deaf man novels, possibly. Yeah, it's difficult off the top of your head to think of.
Yeah, because I don't really know. Police procedurals don't really come along as big films, do they?
Not
very often.
Generally.
I think we might have to, when we get to the book, we would be able to comment at the time and answer the question in, this is the one that could be the big budget. Certainly not this one, anyway.
No.
Certainly not Killer's Choice, which is a bit more lower key in terms of, not much.
It's not what you'd describe
as a big budget.
Explosive in
not one of the more sort of explosively dramatic. Yeah, I know what you mean. As you say, some of the 80s ones where you get the more sort of intricate, convoluted plots and sort of some bigger action, I think.
The one with the rap band in it. That's quite...
I don't think I've read that one,
involves a huge music festival as well, and I think the deaf...
That's a deaf man one, isn't it?
Yeah, the deaf man's running around threatening to do something or other.
I definitely haven't read that
one. That's mid-80s.
I need to get onto that.
Yeah.
I can't remember which one that is.
Graffiti? Or is it called graffiti?
Yes, I don't
know. Sounds like we should be an authority on the novels of the 87th precinct, but off the top of my head.
Well, this is a read-through, and although we've all read most of them, except you who have read all of them, we haven't actually all necessarily covered everything.
Nor read them recently until we do the rereads. Indeed. So, yes.
That's the nature of the beast.
It is indeed. But I'm sure they're out there and we will flag them when we podcast them.
Yeah. I'm gonna jump in and suggest that perhaps Ghosts or Bandersnatch might be
Well, you never know. It's that thing of...
What about 80 million eyes, or is it 50 million
80
eyes?
80 million eyes.
80 million eyes. That's...
I like that one, but that always felt to me a bit more like a TV episode of something like Columbo. But
yeah. Vin Diesel is Steve Carella in Ghosts.
Oh, dear. The thing is, that probably end up those would be a better film than many of the other books. Yeah, you know,
possibly.
Certainly as books, they don't. They may not rank highly.
We'll see.
We'll see when we get there.
Remains to be seen.
I think
so it's a bit of a non-answer to that question.
But Mr. or Mrs. or otherwise
we will answer it in one of the next 40 episodes.
We'll keep it in mind, certainly, ongoing.
We'll make it part of our constant thoughts on the matter. Yeah, our mission statement. Also think about films. But yes, it's a good question, even if we've given an awful answer. And the question we received... But seconds... Do you know what? You sent three now.
Oh, my God.
Right, well, let's just have them all.
Right.
Question one.
All right, let's try and answer these quickly.
Does it involve snooker?
No.
Pass.
If you could be any crime writer of the last 100 years, who would you be?
I'd be... I'd be Donald E. Westlake.
Donald E. Westlake.
Oh, good choice.
Because then I would have the pleasure of writing the best crime character of all time.
Okay, very good. Morgan?
I might be Rex Stout.
Ooh, Rex Stout. Yes.
Quite a fan of Rex Stout.
Yeah, such a good name.
The Orcans.
Well, exactly, yeah, a good name. I suspect he was probably a bit like Nero Wolfe in real life, so that's got to be quite a good life, just sort of tending your orchids and eating elaborate meals.
Yeah, I think I'd go for Dashiell Hammett.
Ooh, yeah.
But only because I sort of imagine him to be somewhat like his characters in The Thin Man. I don't know, he probably isn't at all. But, you know, there's, you know, that ability to bring that sort of suave comic nature to it. Because I obviously am suave and comic.
Why are we not going for Evan Hunter?
Well, I just think that would be a bit disrespectful. I think we'd all like to be Evan Hunter. And
he's an interesting character, though, Dashiell Hammett, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Certainly a very moral character that stood up for what he believed in. He'd go to jail because he refused to... I can't remember exactly what it was. He certainly, after his stint in the Pinkertons, ended up being jailed for refusing to rat out some left-wing conspirators of some sort.
Oh, yeah, I don't really know that much detail in his background. He was a very interesting character.
Interesting man, definitely. Cool choice.
Yeah.
Or he could be Conan Doyle and believe in fairies.
Well, that's always fun.
We're sort of stretching the 100 years definition by that, though, aren't we? When did he die?
He would have died in... He was still writing them...
Well, yeah, I mean...
In the early 20s, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Fair enough. I think the last one...
So you'd either be...
Something, it was relatively late.
So you'd either be Donald E. Westlake or you'd be Arthur Conan Doyle when he believed in fairies.
No, I'm just saying one could be, but Donald E. Westlake.
Yeah,
great name.
A little bit cooler by that time.
Writing as Richard Stark, of course.
Blimey.
Next question. Question two.
Stephen Moore thinks he was too late for these questions, but I'm going to do it now. Question two, which is better, Edgar Allan Poe's The Pit and the Pendulum or Emmerdale?
Emmerdale or Emmerdale Farm?
Well, he says Emmerdale specifically. I think
so
if he'd asked Emmerdale Farm, we could have had...
of Emmerdale Farm.
Emmerdale Farm, we're going to...
I've only
Emmerdale
ever seen
Farm.
The film of Pit and the Pendulum, and it's very good. But I'd say Emmerdale.
Well, I love the book, The Pit and the Pendulum, and I remember getting... When Penguin had, was it a 60-year, thing? And they did these things called Penguin 60s, the little mini volumes. They were, tiny little orange books. And I got The Pit and the Pendulum... Mm. And I sat down to read it, and I just could not stop, and I was horrified, and I was absolutely just, it was literally the first time it's like, that was a page turner. I could not stop, horrified, needing to know, but not wanting to know. So it, but you know, Emmerdale Farm had Fraser Hines in it, and he was in Doctor Who. I don't think this could ever be successfully answered, but Morgan, if you have an opinion.
I think, as you say, The Pit and the Pendulum's a particularly good Poe story, isn't it? It's got that kind of clammy, sort of paranoid, sort of creeping terror that he specialised in so well. But although Emmerdale can also cause those feelings as well. So it's a tough call. Edgar Allan Poe's Emmerdale, I think, is probably the one I'd go for.
The biggest trouble I've got is there's no big airline disaster in Pit and the Pendulum, which always thought was a big failing.
Yeah.
Whereas Emmerdale, you know.
Morgan went to school with someone who was in Emmerdale.
Oh,
well,
that's true,
he?
Yeah, yes.
So we'll leave that hanging.
You didn't
air.
Go to school with anybody in Pit and the Pendulum, so.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I think it's a draw.
There we go. If Ed McBain were a Britpop band, which one would he be?
Ooh.
Shut up, Stephen. Not you, Stephen, other Stephen. I'm not answering that one. I don't think that's a fair question. Because, you know, he's
we
never going
to
define, be menswear.
We need to define.
Define Britpop.
Oh, Britpop or boy band?
A Britpop band.
Oh right, I thought you said Britpop boy band, and
Britpop
I was Britpop
boy band.
Yeah,
that's just a tongue twister.
Shed Seven.
Oh,
excellent.
Well, there we go.
For the same reason as Marco Fu, i.e., there isn't one.
Excellent.
And on that bombshell.
I'm not answering his last question, which insists on us dividing the main precinct characters into Democrat or Republican.
Oh, that's actually an interesting question.
Well, yeah.
Well.
I think you project too much of your own beliefs onto them in some cases.
Mm. Andy Parker, who we've yet to come across, he'd be a
Republican.
Yeah. Roger Haviland.
Possibly.
Ollie Weeks.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Mm-hmm. All Republicans.
So all the characters I've met so far, most of them, yeah.
Most of them would be Democrats, wouldn't
Democratic,
they?
Democratic. But you never know. You never know.
It's hard to tell, especially in the sort of that era in the 50s. Different, very different.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it was. I think in those days were the Republican Party was a bit more centrist, I would say. Well, I would say they both were.
Yeah, but well.
I'm no expert in America.
So there we go. We had a lot more questions than expected.
Emmerdale Farm, though.
Emmerdale Farm, I also do want to mention a couple of things. I've had some... Dr. Andy Davies, who asked us our question about snooker, I would just like to say he has just co-edited a book that's been released. So I'm giving him a free plug for 10 Years on the Parish, the autobiography and letters of George Garrett, who was a merchant seaman in the 1930s. And if you've got £85 to spend on the hardback, you can buy it from University of Liverpool Press. Or £12 for the paperback. So... There you go, if you're interested in...
£85.
They're
bargain.
Always like that. Anything published by a university publisher always has this ludicrous paperback, hardback priced edition.
No wonder they don't sell in their millions.
No, well, that's it. They just sell them to libraries, don't they? But on the subject of academia again, I've also been in contact with Professor Erin E. MacDonald, who wrote Ed McBain / Evan Hunter, A Literary Companion, which is like the definitive academic sort of reference text about Ed McBain,
Crikey.
Of which there's not many,
well,
admittedly, but this I've referred to this a few times.
Somebody
in doing
knows
a bit
what
research.
They're talking about.
Yes, so I have been in contact, and hopefully we will be able to perhaps ask her some questions at some point. She's in London, Ontario. So
probably questions that don't involve snooker and Emmerdale Farm. But you never know. You never know.
Yeah, indeed. Well, she's working on a book about Rebus and Tartan Noir at the moment. So, you know, this is all British ephemera. We're,
so it might be about sort of the high road and,
and
Scotch
curling,
eggs.
Curling. Right.
This is going well.
I just wasn't expecting that. Oh, dear me. Right, let's just do a quick bit about 1958, okay? So, Who do you reckon was the most famous person? I know the most famous person who was born on the day that the copyright date of this book was registered.
1958.
15th of January, specifically. Everyone knows him. Very famous, very famous.
What walk of life are we talking?
Politician.
Tony Blair.
I'll put you out of misery. It's Boris Tadic, the Serbian president between 2004 and 2012.
Of course. It was on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an interesting year for famous births because if you think about 1958, it's that sort of we're getting to that point where a lot of today's sort of celebrities and stars are being born. So you've got people like that's the year where Bruce Dickinson is born.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Ice-T.
Yes.
Sharon Stone, Ellen DeGeneres, Peter Capaldi, who's brilliant in the new series of Doctor Who.
Classic baby boom.
Yeah, and wait for it, Bobby Davro.
Crikey.
So, yeah, if our Canadian, American, Korean, and so on listeners know who Sharon Stone is, they're definitely going to know who Bobby Davro is.
Yeah, don't bother looking him up.
So, let's get on to the book. Because this is
the book.
Yeah, that's the one. You know, there's that papery thing we've got near us. It's the start of that run of the 87 Precinct novels where they've all got killers something at the title. There's like four in a row, I think. Or they've got killer in the title somewhere.
Yep.
So he's obviously made a decision to go with that as a theme, move away from the something, to this, which is interesting because I think it does feel a little bit like another gear. He's shifted into here again.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. Well, the first four always, in my mind, are like grouped together, and this, he's properly off and running with it now, and it just seems this would be interchangeable sequence-wise with any of the next 10, for example, I would say. So, yeah.
Perhaps for the fact that he introduces a character.
In terms of the style and whatnot, it's,
And I think so. The nature of this book is that basically someone's found shot in a liquor store
in a pool of alcohol. So you trash the store.
And that's the nature of the crime that they've got to solve. But it's far from straightforward in terms of the plot. And actually, I think after the last book, this is another. He does get more twisty turny with this one, and more well, not twisty turny necessarily, but he sets out to make the mystery more complex in the sense of the human element to it.
Try to
understand the psychological way of doing it rather than just the pure graft, which is still going on through this because it's a procedural. The graft is trying to unravel the psychology of the person that has been killed.
You're probably a lot more on the character, the victim's character in this book than many of the others, I would say, that perhaps don't dwell on it so much. But this is more about a story about the victim as opposed to the story about the
perpetrator.
The perp,
yes, indeed. So, yeah, that's one of the really interesting features of the story. But one of the other main ones, an interesting one from a publishing point of view, because I think it was publisher-led this decision, is the introduction of a new character who is called Cotton Hawes.
Mm-hmm.
In which, in this entire book, everyone keeps going, Cotton, what sort of a first name's that? And as I understand it, basically, Ed McBain's publisher said, you can't have Corella as your leading man because he's married. He's not. That's not sexy enough. You need someone to be like the free, sort of rugged, charming one that people can sort of that women will fancy, and
Mayer or Myers married also,
absolutely, yeah.
And Birkling's
he was
engaged,
shacked up more or less, as soon as he sort of turned up in it,
absolutely.
Yeah, so there's an edition of this book where there's an introduction by Ed McBain, I think it's one of the 90s ones. He says, one of the people I dealt with at Pocket Books, who were the publisher at the time, was a man I shall call Ralph, who was definitely not Herbert Alexander, the editor. but he basically he relays a conversation saying that Ralph said, Corella is not an attractive person. He isn't. He is a married man. Oh, I said. And then it goes on to basically Ed McBain imagining treating him like a victim in the French Revolution, because just like, what do you do with these people who come at you with all these ideas? Get rid of them. but so he creates Cotton Hawes as a result of this input. But he's an interesting character.
Indeed.
I think he has an interesting introduction in this one, because nobody likes him, and he doesn't make himself very likeable right from the off.
No.
So what do you think of Hawes in this book, Cotton Hawes?
Yeah, he's quite... Obviously, you know what character he becomes, and you kind of start reading it with him being a bit unpopular in his decision-making and quite arrogant and a bit of know-it-all, but it's kind of completely resolved by the the end of the book. So they kind of... I always recalled his character was different, but I'd forgotten quite how quickly it all gets resolved. And not wishing to be a spoiler, but everything's okay, and he's a good egg by the end of the book.
Yeah, because he comes from the 30th precinct.
He comes from a cushy precinct.
Very cushy.
And if I find the section in my book, page 32, is that it?
So, his character is resolved fairly rapidly, I would say, but it's quite a good way of bringing in the fact that, you know, reiterating the fact that different parts of the city, completely different life, being a cop in different bits.
Yeah, because he sort of says, we didn't have many homicides at the 30th, and he's talking to Corella at the time, and he feels like Corella's getting at him about where he's coming from and being a bit soft. So he says, Corella says, how many? And he says, 6. And he goes, a week? No. A month? And it's, no, 6 homicides in 4 years. Mm-hmm. Now, just counting the homicides we've had in the books we've read, let alone the imaginary gaps in between these, it's the 87th precinct is clearly a lot more killy.
Distinctly killy.
Yeah. But a bit more, actually, there's a little sneaky bit about Corella's character in here as well, because it, and I think that's quite nice, he uses it as an opportunity to restate some bits about Corella, when Corella's sort of defending himself to Cotton Hawes.
Oh, yeah.
Where he sort of goes, yeah, Stephen Louis Corella, detective second grade, 34 years old, been a cop since I was 21. I'm married to a girl named Teddy who's a deaf mute. We're very happy. I like my job. I worked on 41 homicide cases and just about every other type of crime being committed in this city. I made 2 big mistakes in my lifetime. I jumped on a hand grenade in Italy and I got myself shot last Christmas. It's like, so that bit about the hand grenade in Italy, he's like, he's a war hero, not just someone who served. But you wouldn't expect anything less from Corella, really. Lucky he survived this far.
Well, go around jumping on hand grenades,
Yeah, so it's amazing. But yeah, they show off how sort of different Cotton Hawes is by when they go to question a suspect, and they both draw their guns, and it makes it a really good sequence where they're getting ready and Corella draws his gun and then Cotton does the same, sort of sees him as the same. Mm-hmm. He clips off the safety and then Cotton does the same. And, you know, Corella's getting ready to sort of shout and kick the door in, and then Cotton just sort of politely knocks and says, open up, please. And, of course, door gets blasted open and he gets 7 shades kicked out of him.
Yep.
And suddenly, he's a bit more sympathetic to life in the 87th precinct after that. Other things that happen in the 87 and in this book are to do with Roger Haviland. Poor old Roger Haviland.
Poor Roger.
So, what do we think of that?
He could have so easily gone in the first book, but he didn't last too much longer, did he?
No.
No, I think it's interesting. I think he was bored of the character, really.
And
you make him space as well for Cotton Hawes.
Of course, yeah. He's had a bit of fun writing Roger Haviland there, but he's a bit more one-dimensional than some of the kind of dodgy cops who turn up in the precinct later on. It's a bit of a one-note character, so there probably wasn't that much you could do with him.
I've mentioned him a few times. His natural successor, not immediately now, is Andy Parker, isn't he? But he's a little bit more complicated, isn't he? Because he shares some of the traits of being a bit violent and a bit, you know, doesn't give you know, suspects and whatnot much leeway, but he's yeah, he's perhaps got he's a bit more I don't know what I'm looking for.
Well, I think Andy Parker seems a bit more of his time, and I think Haviland seems a bit old hat even at the start of this series, and like he couldn't actually ever get out of the 50s because as things are cleaned up a little bit in the police force, certainly as they're portrayed in these books, they'd have had to have stories about Roger Haviland, and I don't think they would have wanted to. Ed McBain would have wanted to do that.
No. Yeah, Parker's a bit lazier, isn't he? I think a bit more. Yeah, he tries to just do the minimum to kind of get the job done. And
But
he's the replacement dislikable one.
Yeah. Oh, my voice went there. But the means of dispatch for Roger Haviland is having set him up over these past four books as someone who's never going to get caught out again because he was nice once and he got beaten up and all this stuff. It's the one moment we've seen where he actually just goes to check that someone's okay, and that's the point at which he gets pushed through a plate glass window. So it's not a nice way to go.
No.
Sure isn't.
No, definitely not, no.
But it sets up this sort of intertwining sort of B-plot throughout the book as well.
Yeah, the plot of him going is the plot of Cotton.
Yeah.
Earning his stripes.
Definitely, yeah. So it's intertwined that way. But yeah, I remember when I first started reading them, I read that he died, it was like I didn't really go, oh, I'm missing that character.
No, I don't imagine many people did.
No, not even, he wasn't even like Andy Parker and later sort of Ollie Weeks and some of those.
Well,
they're more enjoyable to watch, to read.
Yeah, the books were when Parker's in them are good reads because he's you know, a bit an idiot, but quite funny and just ridiculous things.
Yeah, he's good entertainment value, isn't he? Whereas, yeah, Haviland, you couldn't really ever accuse him of being particularly entertaining in any way.
No.
Yeah, but I think, again, of things like Hill Street Blues, they do that where they have bad cops. They are cops you also want to watch on screen.
Yeah.
Because if they were all just nasty people, you wouldn't want to watch them. You'd want all the good guys to get them straight away, and so they wouldn't have had any shelf life. Sorry for the comparison to Hill Street Blues, Ed. I've got another favourite bit of this. There's two sections in this, and that's Birkling and elevator operators. Yeah. There's just two points where he just has extended sequence where it's Kling sort of riffing with people in elevators.
Oh, yes, I remember. Yeah, the guy who's trapped in the building all day and he keeps asking him what it's like out there.
Yeah. He uses the phrase, I'm a vertical mole, which is a great euphemism for an elevator operator. I wish there was more elevator operators now so we could just call them vertical moles. That sounds quite derogatory, really. It'd rather be a horizontal mole, this person. I'd like to drive trains instead. That's got. And then again, on page 61, Kling's clearly just bored of going up and down in elevators, so just spends the time taking the mickey out of the elevator operator by saying, why don't you become a cop? Because he's sort of like, well, the elevator operator quips about him not being a model, so he starts making fun of him about being a cop. So, yeah, those are the little sequences that just make up the day-to-day of it, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of make the characters interesting and more, and likeable.
There are some, well, there are some excellent characters in this, though. The Mr. Phelps, right at the beginning, who's all the way through the book.
Yeah.
He's an excellent. We were talking about it before, like characters with different traits. You kind of pigeonhole them in one particular place.
Mm.
A real stingy, miserly person that you can't possibly imagine is going to be fairly central to the. To the plot, and then is, and Annie Boone, who takes you all over the place, really, and
Like you say about Phelps, he's interesting because it's the police are trying to be professional throughout, but he's so sort of more concerned about his stock and his seemingly rather than the girl in his shop who's dead that he's. You can sort of sense the cops straining against, like, why are you being like this, you know. And eventually, I think, you know, they they actually do put in some barbed comments.
It's certainly, yeah. I think some of the closing comments of the book sum him up quite nicely, don't they?
Yeah.
And then Annie Boone's mother as well. She's somebody who, yeah, is quite duplicitous as well, depending on who her audience is at the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of very clever characters, really, and I think this more so than many of the other books in that respect. Because the plot's fair. Once you get to the end, it's fairly straightforward, isn't it? It's not massively complicated, but it's just kind of getting there and all the cul-de-sacs on the way that you...
The long and winding road.
Yeah, we explore, but in terms of, you know, it's the type of crime these days with forensic would get sussed out absolutely immediately.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I make a little list of, you know, who's in the books to when I'm doing my research on this. And in the first few, the sort of the amount of cops is a really long list and the secondary characters is quite short. Or it's, you know, it's sort of equal. This one, they've sort of boiled it down on the cop side of it because his squad's really sort of coming together in this, is this sort of core group. But the list of civilians, as it were, which includes perpetrators, victims, witnesses, people in lifts, as it were, is really long.
Yeah,
and he's got to come up with names for most of them, and he's got to features families again in this one. I mean, it's ludicrous. There's a character, the grocery store owner, who he doesn't just call Tony Rigatoni. He gives him a nickname, so he's known to everyone as Tony Tony, which is a nice touch again. Yeah. Maybe that may be from his sort of Italian family background, something like that. Knowing those sort of nicknames, the way people talk, maybe, I don't know. Buck Mosley, that's a good name. Oh, yeah, Jenny Palenko. There's a scene where Cotton Hawes is trying to find someone on his own, and he goes to this apartment block, and he goes and ends up talking to this girl, Jenny Palenko. And she just gets wasted while she's talking to him.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that scene, yeah.
And I think on the cover of the Perma Books, Pocket Books edition of this, the first edition of it, is an illustration, which is basically Cotton Hawes at the door of her apartment. And it's sort of got nothing to do with the story. No. And if you bought that book based on the front cover, you'd have a very strange time. But that's quite a fun sequence as well, because she's clearly trying to get him into bed. he drinks in that short time, probably incapable.
Yeah. I love the closing exchange. Jenny Palenko did not take her eyes from him. What do you like, cop? Carpets, says Hawes politely.
Yeah, the dry wit of Cotton Hawes.
It's quite unusual for Hawes to actually not sleep with someone as well.
He's a little beggar, isn't he? Yes.
Well, I was going to say, he leaves that till the next book where...
He's busy, isn't he?
He's very busy.
We'll be discussing that soon, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Killers pay off, yeah. Very busy indeed.
Yeah, so there is a certain amount of part one, part two to Cotton Hawes' story with this book and the next, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. It's not just he's introduced in this and then he's in the background for a few. Ed McBain puts him at the forefront of this one and the next one as well.
Yeah.
So after you've read the two, he's well and truly, one of the main cast.
Yeah. Tell you another bit I liked about this was after the bit where Hawes almost gets him and Corella shot to death and they get beaten up and all that stuff. The next chapter, chapter 9, is just little cutaways to the houses of all the cops.
All right, yeah.
And it's all of them just sat around at dinner with their families or their partners just going, can you believe it? This guy's just come in here and he's almost killed Steve. And it's just these little sort of, you know, you can imagine it on screen, these cutaways to all these dining tables. It's Maya Maya with his loads of kids around him and it's... It's Bert and Claire, and it's Steve and Teddy as well.
Yeah, Bert and Claire are necking, aren't they?
They are, as is their wont.
As young folk are often doing in the 50s.
And there's even a sequence with Pete Burns, Lieutenant Pete Burns, with his family.
His
now no longer a junkie son.
Well, yeah.
Who looks at him with doe eyes.
They're all eating mash or something.
Just piles of mash.
This is like some, don't know.
I've just read that in.
His lad eats loads of food or something. Well, perhaps that's... Yeah, gobble his food with total adolescent oblivion.
Adolescent oblivion. Wow.
Sounds like a Terrorvision song.
Terrorvision song. Are we getting back to which 90s band would...
Gobble his food, wolfing his food. Yeah, there we go. I didn't think I'd made that up.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think he's trying to make the difference between him being obsessed with food and obsessed with...
heroin.
Getting high.
It's that addictive personality, isn't it?
Clearly.
Yeah, in the living room of Claire Townsend's apartment, she and Detective Birkling were necking.
Necking, eh? And then, of course, it cuts back to Cotton Horse feeling very sorry for himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like that they have a little girl in this who's the daughter of the victim and of also one of the main suspects.
She's not one of the main suspects.
No, she's not one of the main suspects.
That would have been a good twist.
I think there was a comma in there somewhere.
All right.
But, yeah.
And they eventually get her to sign a false confession. She goes to the electric chair in chapter...
Oh, she fell down those steps. I don't know what happened. Or oh, where this accent's from. I listen to enough podcasts where Americans do English accents.
They push
so.
Down a slide aggressively.
Yeah. But they've got this, and Birkling has this amazing little sort of friendly relationship with it, and that helps to sort of get them towards what they need to do. In fact, there's a nice joke bit about where she asks him about, are you a cop like on Dragnet? And obviously, again, before he had a bee in his bonnet about Hill Street Blues, he had a bee in his bonnet about Dragnet. And he's like Dragnet, but better, Kling said. but that's interesting, because again, that then trickles over into the next book for no reason other than some sort of strange continuity between these two stories. Mm. Tiny little bit in the next book that features that character as well.
Ah, yes, that's right, because
he's,
in the next book he's reason to, well,
the next book, he's trying to find a photographer again.
He's in contact with Mr. Boone, isn't he?
Yeah,
as far as the Isola is concerned, it seems to be full of photographers who live on the 16th floor of apartments, so cops have to keep going in elevators up to them and quipping.
Yeah, that's very true. Lots of photographers in this and the next. So,
yes, it must have been a very photo-heavy time. Mm. But then, suppose, I don't know. No, I was trying to think of a social reason for that, but that's for...
Yeah, they not just invented the camera in 1957.
No. Well, no, but there was probably fewer people who... could take professional shots or decent quality ones.
Yeah. The price of cameras would have come massively down post-war, I suspect,
Oh, yeah, well, that's wars for you, isn't it? Mm. The mouse that roared. I think that film's got something to do with wars and economy.
It has. That's tremendous, actually. I saw it again recently.
I haven't seen it for years. I was trying to remember. I mean, what I find interesting about this is the eventual... And this is going to be a spoiler now because I can't discuss it without saying it. The eventual... way that the killing is done, perhaps we shouldn't say who did it, maybe, but the eventual way the killing is done involves someone flying from Miami to ostensibly New York.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not New York, but it is New York.
East Coast city, somewhere in the approximate region of New York. Yeah,
yeah, or a city in a state that borders onto New York State, anyway. Yep. And back again in an evening... Which presumably in 1958 you could just stroll onto a plane, not having to turn up 2 hours earlier, get scanned and pushed around by some grumpy security people.
Well, I'm sure you would, domestic flights in those days.
It would have all been like the glossy photographs of them drinking martinis and smoking and doing whatever else you do on planes in 1958. And plus, of course, internal flights are a lot more run-of-the-mill in America than they are in England, certainly in 1958. The distance presumably between Miami and New York / Isola is probably longer than the size of the UK.
I wouldn't doubt it, It's considerably longer.
But a modern flight from... I had to check this. A modern flight from Miami to New York takes 3 hours. So the time frame does fit that someone could get there, somewhere. And it's not like it takes much time to shoot someone.
They're at the beginning of the party... 6 or 7 or 8 there again at the end.
Yeah,
because the 3 or 4.
But it does rely on the fact that she's gone to the character. Oh damn! ignore the pronoun. That the killer has gone to a party that's going to last from like the afternoon of one day
until
all night to breakfast the next day, and that's standard operating policy for the hotel that she's staying in. Oh, I've done it again.
Look at that. he or she is staying in wearing the red dress that he or she is wearing.
it is a bit preposterous, that, because she was here at the end, but we didn't notice her for the 9 hours in the middle when she'd be going to the airport, checking in, sitting on the flight.
Yeah.
So perhaps it is a bit preposterous, but...
But like many of these things, it's... makes it interesting.
It does,
at the very least.
Well, the classic discounting of somebody because they've got an alibi, only to find their alibi is a load of bunkum.
Bunkum, indeed.
Yeah. I've just noticed, I mean, we're talking about 1958, and just to really annoy me, he clearly wrote it in 1957.
Mm.
On page 150 of our edition, there's a photostat-type reproduction of a driver's licence-type thing. Or automobile registration application, and it's dated 1957. but I think actually, in terms of the story time, it is 1957 still. I'm not sure. I don't know. It's probably something in the past. It'll annoy me if I get a few books in and suddenly I can't trace the actual story timeline of this anymore.
The academic might correct us.
Yeah, well, she may. It's certainly in June of the year that these stories are taking place in, anyway. That's an interesting one. I think we need to now ponder on closing comments, really. Anything to add, particularly, anyone? Go on. It seems like you had something there, Morgan.
I don't know. It's a funny one for me, this. This was the second 87th Precinct book that I ever read. Mm. At the time, I found it a bit underwhelming just because I read it fairly straight after reading Ice.
That's very different then, isn't it?
Yeah. And I must admit, on revisiting it, I find more to appreciate in it, but it's still not one of my favourites. I have to find that a lot of the development is really good and really interesting, and then it doesn't really resolve everything to my satisfaction. I find sort of the conclusion to be somewhat underwhelming.
Interesting. Okay. Well,
it's like there's a lot of mystery created around Annie Boone. I don't necessarily feel like all of it is.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of what is raised is totally unresolved by the end of the book, isn't it?
Yeah, you never really know why she is these different people to different people.
I really want to know. That was kind of the main thing that keeps me turning the pages. Like, this is so fascinating. Why is she all these different? Oh, it's just finished now.
Yeah. The end.
Yeah, especially like the, you know, people thinking she's intelligent and other people thinking she's not.
She's definitely either intelligent or slow.
Or is she an alcoholic or not?
Yeah, a proper party girl.
Yeah, so a lot of it, you're right, is totally left unresolved, but I suspect intentionally. I don't think he's somebody who does things unintentionally.
I'm sure.
I think you're right. That said, I when I reread it this time, I did remember enjoying it the first time round. Yeah, and it's a lot more character-based than some of them are, I would say.
There is a lot of good stuff in there, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it, and I did actually enjoy it more on a second reading, but just a couple of things about it I find a little unsatisfying.
Mm.
Okay, shall we review the scores for the previous ones in the series, briefly? So, Cop Hater got 86, The Mugger got 76... The Pusher got 75 and The Con Man got 83 police shields out of 100 police shields. So, gentlemen, start your brains working out what you're going to award this. Mm. And I'll fire up Kenneth. And I will start. I'm going to give it... Where do I go with this? I like the introduction of a new character, but that always feels a little unsettling. But I like the character and I like the way it's played and I like the nature of integration. It seems realistic. People are a bit unsure of him, and then things happen, and it becomes part and parcel of it. I think it's different to the others in an interesting way. So I think I'm going to go for 78 police shields. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hand over to Stephen.
Yeah, I think 73.
Ooh, 73. Okay, so that's probably
just marginally better than 7 out of 10, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite a lot.
It's got a lot of redeeming features, but yeah, it's perhaps not as exciting as some of the others, or as aside from Cotton Halls and Steve Carella, the detectives don't really get up to huge. Some of them compared to the other books.
Yeah, I think so, they just sort of almost have cameos in a way, don't they, Morgan?
Yeah, well, as I say, I mean, there's some good stuff in there, like the introduction of Cotton Hawes, some good dialogue, some interesting character stuff, but just feel a bit underwhelmed by the resolution of the plot as a whole. So I'm actually going to give my lowest score yet, 62 police shields.
62, wow.
Crikey. Well, six out of ten. Yeah.
It's respectable.
Yeah, absolutely.
All the gaily coloured lights on the side of Kenneth are flashing. There's steam coming out of its base, and that big handle started wobbling unusually. And he returns the figure of 71.
Mm.
Yes, interesting. I think we're starting to see the beginning of a bit more variation in the scores, a little bit as things go on through the series.
But a lot of the early books, those four, they all had very similar scores to each other.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And I think that reflects the fact that even though they go about completely different things, they're fairly similar in content, scope and size, aren't they?
Mm. Yeah.
Generally speaking. And so, yeah, you do notice as the canon goes on, you've got, plots that are a little bit more focused and this one, whereas others are a bit more grander in scale. And
yeah. And again, I don't think that, I think I've mentioned this before, I don't think necessarily that a score in the low 70s is a bad thing necessarily.
Not at all, no.
It's not, until we actually get to some marker of the low end of the series, which I'll be interested to see. But I think they're still a bit of a way off, certainly in my mind anyway.
Yeah.
So, that was Killer's Choice. We'll do a little bit of a bonus episode in a minute. And the next one we'll be looking at is what we sort of described as part two of the Cotton Whores introduction series, which is Killer's Payoff, which is a very interesting story. And so, from now, from here, till then, etc.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Fare thee well.
Bye.